Okay, we're going to jump into this transfiguration account with both feet this week. Let's go ahead over to chapter 17 of the book of Matthew. And it's important to see that this is carryover from what he said previously. He's going to now put into an historical experience on the earth what he's been describing. He's been giving them these words of comfort. And he's going to now bring them into that in a pictorial way with this epiphany. I remember last week we looked at kind of the technical aspects. You have theophanies, which are when God doesn't actually appear, a divine being doesn't appear, an angelic being doesn't actually appear. But you can tell they're there by what's going on in nature. The mountains are melting, the rain is falling, the earthquakes and the rumbles and all that. That's a theophany. That's like Sinai. And then there's visions, whereby the vision doesn't actually happen on the earth. It's more the heavenly curtains opening up, and there's a vision, like Peter in early Acts. But this, what we're dealing with here in chapter 17, is an epiphany. And it's multiple epiphanies we saw last week. And it's an actual event that occurs on the earth. A heavenly event that originates in heaven, but it occurs on the earth. And we'll see how that ties in to Matthew's presentation of the gospel as well. So now it's important to see that this chapter 17 flows out of what he was just talking about in the last verse of chapter 16. So let's look at verse 28 of Matthew 16. Verily, I say unto you, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his glory. And now verse 1, and after 6 days, Jesus seeketh Peter, James, and John, and his brother, taketh Peter, James, and John, and his brother, and brings them up into a high mountain. And he begins, it's going to go on with this transfiguration account. So he's pulling in where he left off. He's going to fulfill what he left off at the end of chapter 16, and he's going to look at that now. Now Jesus fulfills his promise that some would see the Son coming in his kingdom glory with the transfiguration. Now for the apostate nation, for the unbelieving, the wicked generation, what he had said before were words of warning. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, it's not going to be good news for that apostate, unbelieving generation, the wicked generation. But for the believing remnant, those who are following Jesus, those who appear to be giving up their life are going to receive life in that kingdom. And they're going to have a foretaste of it here. Those of the wicked generation who appear to be saving their lives, maintaining their lives, are going to lose it. They're going to be excluded from the kingdom. But this believing remnant who appears from worldly standpoint, earthly standpoint, to be losing, giving up things, losing this earthly life, they're the ones who are actually going to receive it in that kingdom. And he's going to come now. He's going to come in the glory of the Father. That's important to realize when we get into that transfiguration account. It's the glory of the Father, and it has to do with the kingdom, the coming of the kingdom. And so that's what he's going to lead in here, and that's what they need to realize, is even they've already given up. In a few more chapters, Peter is going to say the 12 have already given up everything. They've given up their earthly life. They're following him. They're participating in God's plan and purpose for restoring national Israel. They're carrying their cross. They're going that direction. Jesus has blazed the trail. He's cleared the path. God's the Father is going to provide them with a perfect provision and have everything provided them before they even ask. And God, the Holy Spirit, is going to empower them to do these things. And he's going to, just like in the Exodus in the Old Testament, in Exodus there, he's going to carry them out of Egypt, carry them out of the world, carry them through this tribulation period as on eagle's wings and bring them to himself. And transfiguration is going to tell them what it's going to look like when that occurs. So let's go ahead and let's just work our way through this transfiguration account. Look at some of its details. Verse 1, and after 6 days. Now, it's interesting here. He says, after 6 days. If we won't turn there now. We're not going to go through Matthew, Mark, Luke, all relay this transfiguration account. We're going to look at a couple things in Luke. We may look at a thing or two in Mark, but we're not going to list these all out and do a detailed comparison of every single one. But we'll bring out some highlights. And here's one of the first highlights when Luke talks about the transfiguration. Here Matthew says after 6 days, and Luke says about 8 days. So I guess you could say that if it's after 6 days, it's the seventh day. And if it's about 8 days, well, that could be the seventh day too. So we're going to assume this is 7 days after what though? What did he just talk about? What's the whole point of this transfiguration account? You got to go back to chapter 16, verse 21. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised again on the third day. That's what Jesus is trying to teach them. He's trying to teach them the plan and purpose of the Father. Did they receive it? Did they listen to him? Verse 22 of chapter 16. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him. And he said, be it far from thee, O Lord, this shall not happen to you. Did Peter hear him? Did Peter listen? Did Peter receive Jesus' teaching? Absolutely not. He rebuked him and said, this thing is never going to happen. And now we're coming to this transfiguration point. Guess how this transfiguration is going to end? It's going to end with a voice from heaven and said, that's my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him. That's the whole point of this transfiguration. And that really sets up the rest of the book of Matthew, because you know what we're going to be asking now? We're going to be asking, is that Peter and the 12 and the believing remnant in general, are they going to start listening to Jesus? That's going to be the suspense, the plot suspense, I guess you could say, as we go through the rest of Matthew. All right, so after 6 days, we could say the seventh day. In the Bible, numbers do have significance. Here we have number 6, the number of man, the number of 7. Is very often associated with perfection and Israel's prophetic program. I don't know that you can read all that into this passage. Seems to me like if he meant us to take note of the 7, he would have just said 7 days. If you like that kind of numerology stuff, you probably could associate some meaning to the 6 days and the 7 days and the 8 days. But we're going to go and look and see what he does next. Verse 1, chapter 17, verse 1. And after 6 days, so we're going to assume it's 7 days, it's a week after he starts teaching them about the death and resurrection of Christ. And he says, and he takes Peter, James, and John. So he chooses 3 of the disciples, 3 of the 12, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart. So Jesus takes James, Peter, and John up to a high mountain. And what does he do after 7 days? Look at verse 2, and was transfigured before them. So he's going to transfigure himself before them. Now this is, as we get some more details, especially from Luke, it'll color this picture a little. But we'll just start with this. This is Peter, James, and John being taken by Jesus up into the mount. Now the question is, when we just read Matthew, we don't really know what Jesus is taking him up into the mount to do. But if we go to Luke 9, you might want to stick a piece of paper if you have an extra paper in Luke 9, because we'll be flipping back and forth. If you go to Luke 9, you'll see what he took them up there to do. And that's what I find very interesting. Go to Luke 9, verse 28. Luke 9, verse 28. And look at verse 27, so you can see we're talking about the same account here. But I tell you of a truth, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the kingdom of God. That's what we just read in Matthew. Verse 28, and it came to pass about, now here he says, about 8 days after these sayings, he took Peter, John, and James and went up into a high mountain. And for what purpose? To pray. He took them up there to pray. Now, I'll just give you a little hint of the story that we're going to see. It's going to play a role later. Instead of praying, they fell asleep. See, that's what happens when you don't listen to Jesus when he explains his plan and purpose. See, we think prayer, we're talking about this in Romans 8, we think prayer is our right to just bust into God's throne room whenever we want, make demands of him, and then wait for him to do everything we want. That's not prayer. Prayer is going to God and talking and communing with him in accord with his plans and purposes, what he's doing. And what he's doing here in this account with the ministry of Jesus, that the primary purpose is that he is sending Jesus to go to the suffering in Jerusalem, go to that death on the cross, and be resurrected from the grave 3 days later. That's his purpose. But what did Peter and the 12 just do in the chapter 16? They rejected that purpose. They rebuked him and said, that's never going to happen. They didn't have anything to pray about. So they fell asleep. And we'll see how that unfolds here as we go through this account. Prayer is communing with God about his plan, purpose, and things. And if you throw those away, then you throw away the content of prayer, and you may think you're praying, you may assume you're praying, but you're not, you're just falling asleep. Let's go back to Matthew now. So he takes them up there, Peter, James, and John, his brother, and brings them up into a high mountain, and he brought them there to pray. But I've already told you that they don't pray, they fall asleep. So let's go to the second stage here. Now I know, hopefully you've gotten the printouts. I know I've broken every rule of PowerPoint presentation today. I've got way too many words in here. But I just wanted one slide per aspect of the Transfiguration show. So I broke the rules. I did it knowingly. And hopefully it's still legible so that you can see it. So let's go to verse 2 now. Verse 2. And he was transfigured. This is Jesus now. And he was transfigured before them. And his face did shine as the sun. And his raiment was white as the light. So Jesus is now transfigured before them. He's the three disciples. And the important thing to realize here is this. He's transfigured with kingdom glory. This is not, I don't believe anyway, this is the way this passage is usually taught, at least the ways I've seen and heard and read in commentaries, is usually this is described as Jesus revealing, opening up his inherent divine glory. This is Jesus, who we know is absolute God, and here he's being transfigured and he's revealing who he is on the inside. He's an absolute God. He's shining forth the brightness of divine glory. But I don't think that's the case. I think if you say that in this passage, you miss the whole point of this passage, because this passage, he's trying to show his disciples the glory they're going to have in that kingdom. And so let's look at this glory concept. He was transfigured. And again, I don't think this is him displaying his divine glory as God. This is God the Father transforming and transfiguring the man Jesus with kingdom glory. And there's a couple reasons why I think that's the case. The first of all is the case is that these are passive verbs. That means Jesus isn't the one doing these things. Someone else is transfiguring Jesus. And of course, that someone else is God the Father. Look what it says here. And Jesus, we put the, he's referring to Jesus here. And Jesus was transfigured. Someone else transfigures him to make his face shine and his clothes be white. And so God the Father is transforming the man Jesus with kingdom glory. This isn't Jesus revealing his divine glory. This is God transfiguring him with kingdom glory. And why that's so important is he's doing this for the disciples. This is the glory the disciples are going to have when they go in that kingdom. Obviously, they're not going to have Jesus' divine glory, but they're going to have God the Father's glory. Look up at verse 27. It says, for the Son of Man, this is verse chapter 16, verse 27, for the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father. What he's revealing here isn't his own personal glory as absolute God. It's his glory that the Father is transfiguring him as a man with kingdom glory. The point is, he's demonstrating to them what they're going to actually participate in. The glory of that kingdom. Now let's look at an example when Jesus reveals the glory of his deity and just see how that's presented. Go to Hebrews 1. Hebrews 1, and we'll see a little different aspect of this. Hebrews 1. And now let's look at Jesus displaying, shining forth his divine glory. Look at verse chapter Hebrews 1, and we'll just... God at sundry times, this is verse 1, had spoken different ways. Now he's speaking through the Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the world. So he's talking about the Creator God here, God the Son as the Creator God, who, being the brightness of his, the God's glory, that's divine glory. Jesus Christ as God the Son, the Creator God, absolute God, shining forth with the brightness, the effulgence of God's glory. And he's the express image of his, God's person, the express image. This is God. This is Jesus Christ in the brightness of his divine glory shining forth. And upholding all things with the word of his power and so forth. That's God, Jesus revealing the and shining forth with the brightness of his divine glory. But here in the transfiguration, we have God the Father transfiguring Jesus with the man with that kingdom glory. So one reason for that is a passive verse. First of all, it's not something Jesus is revealing on his own. It's something God the Father's doing with Jesus. Makes his face to shine and his clothes to be white. Now keep that in mind here. Look, I have a second reason why I think this is the kingdom glory rather than Jesus' inherent divine glory. And that is, first of all, the passive verbs that are used here. But second of all, we've run into this exact same phrase someplace else in Matthew. This phrase where he says, his face did shine as the sun. We've already read that. Does anyone remember? Anyone want to yell out a passage? We've already read that in Matthew 13. So flip back a couple pages. This time, he uses the same verbiage, but it's not referring to Jesus. It's referring to the disciples, to his followers, to the righteous. Matthew 13, verse 43. Then, after explaining what's going to happen to the unbelieving people, the unrighteous, he then explains in verse 43, then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who hath ears to hear, let him hear. If that's what Jesus is putting on display here. He's putting, God the Father has taken Jesus and he's transfigured him with kingdom glory. And it's the point of it is that he's showing those who are following him, who are denying self, who it looks like they're giving up their life now, but are really gaining it. They're gaining the glory of this kingdom, life in that kingdom. And he's making that known. All right, so let's go back to Matthew 17. So Jesus transfigured before them, the three disciples, with kingdom glory. His face shone like the sun, and the clothes became white as light. And we talked about the passive. This is something God does with him, and this is something that all the righteous are going to participate in that kingdom. Let's look at something about the face shining and the clothes. Let's go. I told you to put a mark if you had a piece of paper in Luke. We're going back to Luke 9. We'll be flipping back and forth a little bit there. And we'll probably even look at Mark 9 on the way back to Matthew. But let's look about those clothes. Let's look how it's described. Matthew describes it as his raiment was white as light. Look how Luke describes it. Luke 9, verse 29. And as he prayed, remember, they've gone up there with the disciples, but it only says in this account, he prayed. And you wonder, well, what did the other disciples pray or not pray? And we're going to find out, no, they didn't pray. They fell asleep. And he went up to pray. He's going to go, what's he going to go talk to the Father about? He's going to go talk to the Father about what he just told the disciples. He's got to go to Jerusalem. He's going to suffer all things at the hands of his own people. He's going to go to his death on the cross, and he's going to be raised again on the third day. That's what he's praying about. Peter and the 12 rejected that, didn't listen to that. So now they don't have anything to pray about, so they fall asleep. Jesus, though, was praying, and the fashion, verse 29, of his countenance was altered, and the raiment was white and glistering. Now, I didn't know what to do with the word glistering, so I was going to look it up before I came, but then I forgot. So I'm going to just think it has like sparkling and glistening kind of idea. But now look what our passage, our account in Mark says. And I find this humorous. I always like a little humor in my messages. Go to Mark 9. Remember, the way we typically think of these gospels, you got Matthew. He presents Jesus Christ as the Son, as the King. Luke as the man. John as God. And what does Mark describe Jesus as? The servant, right? Now look how Mark describes his clothes. I find this very humorous. I don't know if anyone else will, but Mark 9, verse 3. This is the same transfiguration account, and this is what Mark says in verse 3. And his raiment became shining. That's kind of like what Matthew and Luke said. Then he adds in exceeding white as snow. Now he compares it to snow, but listen to his last description here. So as no fuller, no laundromat, no washer of clothes, no soap, no bleach, no stain remover on earth could make them this white. Don't you get the idea? Mark has washed some clothes in his life, and he's amazed at how white these clothes are. Nothing on earth could make them this white. I guess you could say they're an unearthly whiteness. They're being transfigured by the clothes and the shining of the face with that kingdom glory that they're all going to participate in that kingdom. All right, so the clothes were unearthly white. If we want to, maybe for your notes, Revelation 3:5, it talks about people dressed in white clothing. All right, let's go back to Matthew 17. So we have here Jesus is transfigured. God has made his face to shine and his clothes so white, nothing on earth could get him that white. So it must be God doing it. And to show them what this kingdom glory is going to look like that they can participate in. And behold, verse 3. Behold, verse 3. There appeared unto them Moses and Elijah, talking with him. So now we have the 12, and they're now what appears to them is Moses and Elijah, and they come in glory too. They're coming in this glory. How do we know that? Go back to Luke 9, verse 31. Luke 9. verse 31, and they be I'm in Luke 8. Better if I get into Luke 9. And verse 30 and 31, and behold, there talked with him two men, which were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory. So they're in this kingdom glory as well, and they're all there talking. And it says they were talking with him. They were talking with Jesus. They weren't talking to the disciples. Of course, we know the disciples are sleeping. They're talking with Jesus while he's praying to the Father about his... Well, let's see. What were they praying about? If you're still hopefully in Luke 9, let's see what they were praying about. What were they praying about? Look at verse 31. Luke 9, verse 31. They're talking with Jesus, who appear in glory, and spoke of his decease, which he should accomplish in Jerusalem. What are they all talking about? The one thing Peter wouldn't talk about is what all the important beings in the universe are talking about. Jesus is talking about it with the Father in his prayer, and now Moses and Elijah are talking about it. They're talking about his upcoming decease at the hands of his own people in Jerusalem as he goes to his death on the cross. And never forget the last phrase, and will be raised again on the third day. That's what they're talking about. The one thing Peter and the 12 didn't want to talk about is what all the important people in the universe are talking about. Peter and the 12 and the believing remnant have to listen to Jesus. That's the point of this whole transfiguration account. They have to listen. They have to listen. It's important to realize it happened during this prayer, but they weren't listening. They were sleeping. And prayer is talking and communing with God based on his plan and purpose. If you reject his plan and purpose, you don't have anything to pray to God about. So you're just going to fill it in with whatever you want. And you'll add in human thoughts and worldly thoughts and religious thoughts and man-made theological system thoughts. And you'll make up all the things you want, think you can get God to do. But you see, it's not prayer and communion with God. Prayer and communion with God is recognizing what he's revealed to you he's doing and talking to him about that. And Peter and the 12 rejected that. They rebuked him. This will never happen to you. They didn't have anything to talk to God about, so they fell asleep. Jesus, Moses, Elijah, all glorified in the Father, all were talking about the death and resurrection of Christ. That's what Peter needs to start talking to Jesus about, talking to the Father about. That's what he needs to hear Jesus say. The point of this whole to this point of this whole account. To enter into this earthly glory, remember we're flowing out of the end of chapter 16 where he gives those words of warning to the apostate element, the unbelieving nation, the wicked generation, and the believing remnant. It's the words of warning to the unbelieving element, and there's a words of a comfort to the and encouragement to the believing remnant. And to what they need to realize is entering into that kingdom doesn't come from the system that's on earth now. It doesn't come from their power. It doesn't come from their teachings. It doesn't come from anything associated with that vain religious system that they were experiencing and suffering under then. They needed to leave that because what to be a member, to participate in the kingdom, what it required is for God the Father to transfigure you for entrance into that kingdom. Something the wicked generation, with their power they had now and their physical things they had then and their power, couldn't do. Entrance into that kingdom requires being changed into the glory of that kingdom. These are words of comfort to them. That's what they're going to participate in. That's what's ahead for them. This is a heavenly event that occurs on earth. Remember, that's the whole point of me calling it an epiphany. It's something of heavenly origin, but it occurs on earth. And this fits very nicely with Matthew. You know, most of the other gospel writers, how do they describe the kingdom? It's the kingdom of God. the kingdom of God on earth. How does Matthew refers to it that way sometimes, but how does he usually refer to it? The kingdom of heaven on earth. God is going to carry out his plans and purposes on that come from heaven, but he's going to carry them out on earth. He's going to establish the earthly creation in kingdom glory. He's going to transfigure the whole earthly creation with kingdom glory. All right, let's go to the next stage of this transfiguration. And we got Moses and Elijah now. And question is, what's going on here with Moses and Elijah? Verse 3, "And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with him." All right, so we've already looked at what they were talking about. We saw that in Luke 9. They're talking about Jesus' decease in Jerusalem, him going to Jerusalem, suffer at the hands of his own people. Go back to chapter 16, verse 21. Look at the end of verse 21 in chapter 16. He says, "And go to Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes." It's his own people. He's going to suffer at their hands, be killed, and be raised again on the third day. Now you get to this transfiguration account. Jesus is going and he's talking to the Father about that. And as he's talking to the Father about that, God the Father transfigures him with kingdom glory and brings him together with Moses and Elijah in glory. And guess what they're all talking about? His going to Jerusalem, suffering at the hands of his own people, going to that cross, to death on the cross, and being raised again on the third day. They appear to do that. They appear to the three disciples, but notice they only speak to the transfigured Jesus. They don't speak to the 12. Well, of course, we maybe can't tell when the 12 or when the three disciples woke up. We know they were asleep. They might have slept through the whole thing. They might have woke up halfway through, but they're not even talking to the disciples. They're talking to Jesus. And they appeared in kingdom glory. We saw that in Luke 9:31. And they spoke about Jesus' exodus, his unjust death that was about to take place in Jerusalem at the hands of his own people and be raised again from the dead. And that's what Peter and the 12, and Peter as a representative of the 12 and the believing remnant, he just rebuked Jesus for that. He refused that teaching. Peter, to the point of this transfiguration, and when it closes with the command from the voice from the cloud that Peter and James and John and the rest of the 12 and the believing, they needed to listen to Jesus, especially with regard to the suffering, death, and resurrection. And so he brings in Elijah and Moses, and I guess we could ask, what's the point of Moses and Elijah? The way this is usually explained, typically, is that Moses, you know, he's the spokesman for the law. And then they say Elijah is the spokesman for the prophets. So it's kind of Matthew's way of putting together basically the whole Old Testament, Israel's whole history under the law and the prophets. The only problem with that is, while no one would argue that Moses is the spokesman for the law, Elijah isn't usually considered the head person for the prophets. If you go by quotes, Isaiah, Jeremiah would have many more references than Elijah. And, you know, even Peter in the Acts account, when he goes back and follows the line of the prophets, he doesn't go to Elijah. He goes to Samuel. He goes back to the first prophet in Israel's courses of punishment, the prophet for the first course of punishment. So there's no indication that Elijah was the representative prophet. And he wasn't even a writing prophet. And so while that may be some truth in that, I think there's a bigger reason for why Moses and Elijah were chosen here. And that bigger reason is in the mode of their death. Of course, we know Elijah didn't die. And we know Moses died, but it was basically at the hand of God, and God buried him. We know Elijah didn't die. He was just taken up. Let's look at the accounts, and let's see if there's might not be a bigger reason here for picking these two. And maybe they were appearing now because of the uniqueness of both of their deaths. In the light, in the context of what Jesus has just been trying to teach the disciples about his death. So let's go to 2 Kings. 2 Kings, and let's look how Elijah died. 2 Kings, go to chapter 2. 2 Kings 2. 2 Kings 2, and we're not going to read through this whole account. Most of you know this account, basically. But I just want to bring out that Elijah didn't die. Like, basically, everybody except maybe Enoch back in Genesis, he didn't die that way. Look at what it says about him. Verse 1. 2 Kings 2, verse 1. And it came to pass when the Lord would take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind. You know what a whirlwind is kind of like? It's kind of like a cloud, a storm cloud, a cloud. Remember what's coming up in our transfiguration account? There's going to be a cloud. And he pulled up by a whirlwind that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. Then he goes through. He's going to make a little journey here. He's going to try and get Elisha to stay behind. Elisha keeps following him. And now let's just go to the end of the story in verse 8. He also has 50 of the men from the school of the prophets following along. They're at a distance. They're watching him because Elijah's going to be taken up. And they're following along, watching from the hilltops and seeing what's going on. Elisha is following Elijah. And this is what happens. Verse 8. And Elijah took his mantle and wrapped it together and smote the waters, and they were divided hither and thither, so that the two, Elijah and Elisha, went over on dry ground. And it came to pass when they were gone over that Elijah said unto Elisha, ask what I shall do for thee before I be taken away from thee. He's going to be taken away. And Elisha said, I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. And he said, thou hast asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou see me when I am taken up from thee, it shall be so unto you. But if not, it shall not be so. Now, I bring that one out. I'm just going to say, stick those couple verses in your memory, because that little scene there is going to be important in the verses after the transfiguration. He's going to talk about John the Baptist and Elijah. And so keep that in your mind. What just happened here between Elijah and Elisha, keep that in mind, because when we get to Elijah and John the Baptist, we're going to read some similar things. So let's look at verse 11. And it came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire and parted them both asunder. I'll give you a little heads up. When the cloud appears in our transfiguration account, it separates Elijah and Moses from Jesus. It's going to pull them apart, and it's going to eventually take them back up and leave Jesus behind. So here you have the horses and parted them both asunder, separated Elijah and Elisha, and went up in a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, and so forth. And we're not going to read anymore, but that was Elijah's death. The whole context of the transfiguration is Christ's upcoming death on that cross at the hands of his own people in an ignominious death of the cross, and then he'll be raised from the dead. Here we have Elijah has a unique death because he doesn't die. He's just taken up. Let's read about Moses' death. Moses' death. Go to Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy 34. Go back a couple books in Deuteronomy 34, verse 5. Deuteronomy 34, verse 5. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there. Remember what's just happened before this. He's re-given the curses of the law, which are basically outline their history like Leviticus 26 does. He outlined their history. They're going to fall under those curses. He's warned them about them. And now he's rehearsed the law with them for the second time. And now he's going to, remember, they're ready to enter into the land, but Moses isn't going to be allowed to enter into the land because of his rebellion. Some rebellious things he did earlier in the wilderness. And so now let's pick it up at verse 34. And now he's going to be ready. He's ready to die. God is going to call him and say it's time for him to die because he's not going to allow him to go into the land. So verse 5. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab according to the word of the Lord. Now you might say, we're going to find out he's 120 years old. We might think Moses just, died like a normal person would die, most of us, long before we hit 120. But see, that's really not an option, because look down at verse 7. And Moses was 120 years old when he died, but his eye was not dim, and his natural force, his natural strength was unabated. He was still operating like a 20-year-old, full-sighted and full in strength. The Lord put him to death. The Lord took him and the Lord brought about his death and buried him. Verse 6, and he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab over against Beth Peor, but no man knows of his sepulcher unto this day. And look what the response of the children of Israel is. We saw with Elijah, yes, he was persecuted by his own people during his ministry and everything. But actually, we probably could have read a few more verses in 2 Kings 2. You would have seen he had an honorable death. Elisha takes over and the 50 men from the school of the prophets come and they're going to honor Elijah. Is removed. He doesn't die. God takes him up and he has an honorable death. What happens afterwards? Here, Moses, yes, he suffered and was persecuted by his own people in those wilderness wanderings. But when he dies and the Lord buries him, he doesn't die at the hands of his own people. He doesn't die an ignominious death. Look what it says in verse 8 here. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. He had an honorable death. Elijah had an honorable departure. When you come to the transfiguration, let's go back there. And now compare what Jesus has said about his death. And you can't, they're not up there in the transfiguration. I've tried to make this plain. And what they're talking about, they're not just chattering about things or, what it was like back in ancient. They're talking about his death, his upcoming death, his upcoming suffering and death at the hands of his own people, in an ignominious, dishonorable death on the cross. That's not the way Elijah left, departed. That's not the way Moses departed. Jesus' death is separate and distinct. His is going to be requiring suffering, ignominy, a death on the cross, but God's going to raise him from the dead. It's going to require a resurrection from the dead. And then he'll be honored. So we have Elijah was taken up by God without dying at his hands. He didn't die, but Jesus is going to need to die. Moses died, but not at the hands of his own people in shame. Moses didn't die an ignominious death. And can you see what might be going through the disciples? Now they're asleep. And I'm assuming, based on kind of how you read Matthew 16, they wake up in the middle of this conversation that's going on between Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. And they wake up and they're like, looking at all these glorified people, maybe they've heard the whole talk, maybe they've just heard him talking partially. And I could see them, remember, they're in a state of having rejected what Jesus just said about his death. And I could see Peter maybe thinking, maybe I'll set up some tabernacles here because maybe Jesus is getting some new instruction. Elijah didn't have to die. Maybe Jesus doesn't have to die. Moses died, but he didn't die at the hands of his own people in an ignominious death. Maybe Jesus doesn't need to die at an ignominious death at the hands of his own people. Remember back in verse 22, Peter rebuked him. This will never be so. And he looks, and the people there glorified with Jesus. They're ones who didn't die at all, and one who died, but it was an honorable death. And you have coming right out of Jesus' teaching that they rejected, that he had to die and suffer ignominy at the hands of his own people in a dishonorable death. And maybe Peter was thinking, maybe we can prolong this. Maybe we need to get more of this information. Maybe Jesus can be treated like Elijah, or Jesus can be treated like Moses. So let's see what Peter does next. I think he may be wondering, maybe Jesus' instructions have changed here with regard to the suffering and death have changed. All right, so let's go to the next stage of this. And let's see, verse 4. So here you have all that going on here. You have Jesus transfigured before them. They're going to fall asleep someplace in here. They wake up, and there's the glorified Moses and Elijah talking to the glorified Jesus. They're talking about his upcoming death in Jerusalem. And now Peter, having rejected that truth, he may be looking for an out. Maybe Jesus can die like Elijah or be removed like Elijah and not have to die. Or maybe he can be like Moses and die an honorable death. So what's Peter's response? Verse 4. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. He's like, now, you know, this could go our way now. If thou wilt, let us make here three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. One for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And now he's going to suggest setting up booths. Now, most people I've heard teaching this, they think this refers to the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles, of course, is associated with Jehovah's name, I'll be with you, and is directly associated with that kingdom as a feast that'll be fulfilled in the establishment of the kingdom. But you know, the only problem, at least I have with that, there's nothing I'm going to fight anyone over, but the problem I have with that is when the Feast of the Tabernacles, you make your own tabernacle, you make your own booth. Here, Peter and the 12 aren't making booths for themselves. They're making booths for the talking, glorified people. They want to make booths for them, tabernacles for them. And I think the idea here, the background of Peter's request here, isn't so much the Feast of Tabernacles, although that is associated with the kingdom. I think he's talking here about the tabernacle of the meeting. Remember what Moses did? What God instructed Moses to do and all the people of Israel? They were to set up a tabernacle, and God would come down what? In a cloud, and he would talk to the people. Let's see how this, what this is referring to here. Go back to Exodus 33. Exodus 33. Remember, this whole transfiguration account all centers on communicating truth. You have the prophets who are communicating. You have Moses who's communicating. You have Jesus who's talking. We haven't got to it yet, but you're going to have the voice of God the Father coming from the cloud, and he's going to tell, listen to him. Everybody's communicating. Everybody's talking. And this is a heavenly activity, heavenly event that's occurring on the earth. Peter says, let's make some tabernacles. Let's set up a tabernacle. And I think the background here, as I said, goes back to this tabernacle of meeting. Go over to Exodus 33, verse 7. Exodus 33, verse 7. And Moses took the tabernacle and pitched it without the camp. We're not going to go back into all the history of all. Do remember, they've been in rebellion, and now God's going, should have come back and consumed them based on the law system they entered into. But instead, he's going to deal with them on the basis of the grace resident in his Jehovah name. And he says, okay, I'll return, but I'm going to set up my tabernacle, the place where you can meet with me out there outside the camp. I can't be in the camp. If I come in this camp, I'm just going to consume you. I'll be out there. And those who want to talk to me can come out there. Verse 7, and Moses took the tabernacle and pitched it without the camp, outside the camp. And then he draws far away from the camp. He's not taking any chances. Far away from the camp, he sets it up and called it the tabernacle of the congregation. And it came to pass that everyone which sought the Lord went out to the tabernacle of the congregation, which was without the camp. And it came to pass when Moses went out unto the tabernacle that all the people rose up and stood every man at his tent door. Remember, they're living in tents at this time, and looked after Moses until he had gone into the tabernacle. And it came to pass as Moses entered into the tabernacle, the cloudy pillar. What's going to be the next scene in our transfiguration? The cloud comes down. The cloudy pillar descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked to Moses. And all the people saw the cloudy pillar stand at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose up and worshiped, every man in his tent. So you have a divine communication going on through this tent, this tabernacle of the congregation of the meeting. And I suggest that's more likely the background to Peter's request here. He sees all these divine, heavenly, glorified people communicating. And I'm thinking he's going to set up a tabernacle and receive those divine communications. Maybe get them to stay a little longer and instruct Jesus he doesn't really have to go to a death, or he doesn't have to go to an ignominious death. Let's go back to Matthew 17. So I believe this refers to the tabernacle of meeting where God dwelt and where he appeared in the cloud and spoke to Moses and the people. The main emphasis is on communication. Everybody's communicating except Peter and James and John. Well, even Peter is communicating here, isn't he? He's talking. He's saying all the wrong things, but he's talking. You know, the only one in this account who isn't talking to, doesn't talk to the disciples is Jesus isn't talking to the disciples. Moses and Elijah aren't talking to the disciples, but God the Father is going to talk to the disciples, the three that are on the mountain here. So I think that he's looking for this furtherance, this continuance of this divine communication, and especially in the context of how this might impact what Jesus just said in chapter 16 about his suffering at the hands of his own people and ignominious death on the cross to be raised again on the third day. Maybe he doesn't need to have that. Elijah never experienced death, and he went to be with God. Maybe Jesus can do that too. Maybe Jesus, Moses, God's spokesman on earth, he died a death, an honorable death, and he was on. Maybe Jesus can at least die in that way. So he offers the tabernacles. Let's see what these divine communication is going to do. Maybe we can get God to operate according to Elijah or Moses. And that's what the climax of this whole account is, because now God the Father is going to speak out of the cloud. And he's going to yell, he's going to pronounce something in a command to Peter and say, stop all your waffling, listen to Jesus. His death is going to require going to Jerusalem, suffering at the hands of his people, his own people, an ignominious death on the cross, but he'll be raised again on the third day. Listen to him. That's what they needed to do. So for Peter's response is wrong and in ignorance, because he was putting Jesus, first of all, on the same level as Moses and Elijah, giving them each a booth. He may have been given some priority to Jesus, but he's basically putting him in the same level. And because their appearance wasn't even temporary. It's just momentary. They're just there for moments. And the kingdom can't be established until what Jesus said happens. It can't be established until after Jesus suffers, is put to death, and is raised again on the third day. So now let's go to verse 5. Now let's get to the next thing here. So you get the flow of this. You got Peter trying to do something here. He's thinking, you know what? I'd rather have Jesus die the way Elijah died. That'd be the best. Maybe he can at least die the way Moses died. And what does God the Father now gets on the scene? And what does he say? While he yet spoke. So God the Father doesn't even let Peter finish talking. He just shuts him down. Shuts him down. The logic Peter's using, the words he's saying, he just shuts him down. And this is what he said. While he yet spoke, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. And now here we get the point of this whole transfiguration. Listen to him. Which they didn't do back in chapter 16. They need to listen to him. Jesus' death isn't going to be a non-death like Elijah's, and it's not going to be a death like Moses. It's going to be a death that goes through the ignominy of that cross. And most importantly, suffered at the hands of his own people. It's a speaking cloud. Two aspects of this cloud. A cloud comes and overshadows Moses and Elijah, but Jesus, as we see in the next verse, is going to be left alone with the disciples. The cloud is reiterating what has already been said several times. Remember at the baptism of Jesus, what is the God the Father? Now there he doesn't even speak through a cloud. He just speaks from heaven. And he says, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Remember when they were on the boat? And Jesus rescued him in the boat. What did the disciples say? This is Jesus is the Son of God. And what did Peter just say in his confession? As an instrument of God the Father, having been taught of God the Father, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And now this voice from heaven comes and reiterates that. This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Hear ye him. And that's what that cloud's going to come down to. He interrupts Peter in his speech and his idea about extending the stay of Elijah and Moses, and maybe that will result in altering the outcome for Jesus himself, and not to mention them. But the cloud comes now and breaks into his speaking and says, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. The cloud comes and it, just like it did in the account with Elijah, separates Moses and Elijah from Jesus and separates them. He's going to take them out. And the only one left now is Jesus. It's a speaking cloud in that it interrupts Peter's speech and issues a command. Listen to him. There's all kinds of verses we could look at. I put it here for the notes where this kind of thing happens. But it's also a vehicle cloud. It moves. It's going to transport Elijah and Moses is removed from the scene. The cloud comes down. It shuts down Peter and everything he's saying and separates Elijah and Moses from Jesus, takes Moses and Elijah back up, and says, this is my beloved Son. Listen to him. And the last thing he told them was about his upcoming death in Jerusalem, suffering at the hands of his own people, an ignominious death on the cross. But what they probably weren't hearing as well is there's resurrection from the dead, raised from the dead after the third day. So they were again afraid. Look at verse, let's pick it up here. So verse 6. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were afraid, or sore afraid. It just shut down Peter, everything he's saying, shut it all down. And Jesus came and touched them and said, arise and be not afraid. These are words of comfort and encouragement. They're a continuation of the end of chapter 16 on through to verse 7 here. And let's read verse 8. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save or except Jesus only. The cloud comes and communicates, listen to him, my beloved son, separates Moses and Elijah from Jesus, takes them back to heaven, and Jesus is left alone with these three disciples and with ringing in their ears, listen to him. Listen to him. Left alone with Jesus, who speaks only words to them, and these are the only words of Jesus to the disciples in this whole encounter, comforts them so they can rehear. See, they needed to be comforted and encouraged. They needed to rehear what he said back in Matthew 16:21. They needed not just to hear it physically, they needed to listen and hear it internally. They needed to receive and accept it. They needed to recognize that's God's plan and purpose. They needed to rehear what he's been trying to teach them. They needed to get behind him. Remember in Matthew 4, where you have the Satan, it's temptation of Jesus out in the wilderness. What does Jesus say to the Satan? He says, it doesn't say, get behind me. He says, get away from me. Just in chapter 16 of Matthew 16, we found Peter rebuking the Lord. And what does Jesus say? He says, get thee behind me, Satan. Peter wasn't sent away. He was told to get behind him. Get with the program. Listen to what I'm saying. Hear me. And that's the point of this transfiguration. They needed to understand he wasn't going to be ascend up like Elijah. He wasn't going to go to an honorable death like Moses. He was going to go to Jerusalem to suffer at the hands of his own people, be put to death in an ignominious way on the cross. Well, what they also needed to hear was be raised again on the third day. This sets up for the whole rest of the book of Matthew. That's what we're going to be saying the whole rest of the book of the Matthew. Is Peter, is the 12, is the believing remnant listening to Jesus yet? It sets up the suspense for all the way now through the end of the book. Will they or won't they listen to Jesus? Sets it all up. Will they or won't they listen to Jesus? And we're going to see next week, his first command after they come down is don't tell anyone. The secrecy component with a reemphasis on his death and resurrection. And that's where we'll pick it up next time, because they are still clinging. They haven't listened to some things he even said earlier than this. They're still clinging to some teaching from that vain religious system. And we talked about this one time in the past. We'll have to cover it quickly next week. They're still clinging to some truth from that vain religious system that they needed to get rid of, especially with regard to John the Baptist and John's ministry.